nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Enjoy the show.
Okay, now to continue what we were discussing last day, remember what I mentioned is that this course is about a kind of different view of how current flows in through different through conductors, because what you usually learn, like most, I think half of you have taken 305, and what you usually learn in any course, whether it's in physics or engineering, wherever you've taken it, is what I'd call a top-down view. That is, where you learn about current flow through big conductors. Big meaning, say, microns, tens of microns long. Because, as I say, 20 years ago, it wasn't really clear what the resistance of something really small would be. So no one quite knew what small things would do. And so everything started from the big end. And when you start from those concepts and try to understand small things, they'll look a lot more complicated than they need to. And so in order to understand nanoscale devices, in devices where you're talking of hundreds of atoms or thousands of atoms long, let's say, and as I said, commercial transistors in your laptops today are a few hundred atoms long, the active region, meaning the length of the channel. For such devices, it's usually, I'd say, more effective to think from a bottom-up point of view, where you start with small things. And what I'd mentioned last day is that the basic expression, the simple version of it, for the conductance of a small conductor looks something like this. Q square over H pi d gamma, where this Q is the charge on an electron. I think I wrote it down last day. Let me put it up here so you have this for reference. The charge on an electron is 1.6 times 10 to the minus 19th coulombs. H is Planck's constant, which is 6.63 times 10 to the minus 34. Joules, and in general we'll be using this MKS unit, except for energy. For energy, often we'll be using what's more convenient to use is something called electron volt, rather than joules, which is the MKS unit. And the relationship between them is, so one electron volt is equal to how many joules?
Should be joules.
Thank you. Very good. So that's H. Oh, and by the way, I often run into another symbol that's often used, which is H bar, which is H divided by 2 pi. Okay. And one electron volt is how many joules? It's like, you see, joules is charge times volts. And this is like, so it's like the charge of an electron times 1 volt, which is 1.6 times 10 to the minus 19. And this is important to remember, because when you start doing concrete numerical calculations, one of the most common problems in the beginning is this, remembering to keep track of this 10 to the minus 19th. Most often answers are kind of off by this factor, which is by no means negligible, but see, and that causes a problem. So you have to learn, you have to get used to, you know, when this should be included and when not, etc. Okay, so this is the basic formula, and I'll try to explain where it comes from. That's what we started doing last day, and today I'll try to continue with that discussion, and we'll get to this formula, and I'll get you a general version that from which you can calculate the current voltage characteristics. That's kind of what I'll try to do today. Okay, now, so one important concept that I kind of stressed last day, which is very important, is that when current flows, what really matters is the states right around the electrochemical potential. And what's the electrochemical potential? Well, it's the line that divides the filled states from the empty ones. Because there's always these energy levels inside your channel, these energy levels in your contacts, they're all filled up to a point below, so all the electrons go into the lowest energy levels. The upper ones are empty, and what line that separates them, that's called the electrochemical potential. Right? Now, when you apply a voltage, what happens is, so let us say we have put a positive voltage across this. Take this out from here. So the drain is positive with respect to the source. Now what that does is it pulls down all the energy levels in the drain, while it pushes up all the energy levels in the source. So when this gets pulled down, it means the levels go down, and so does the chemical potential. So I'll call this a mu 2, because at equilibrium, we had a single electrochemical potential. Now, because I've put this voltage, the two contacts have kind of moved with respect to each other. This drain is held at mu 2, source is raised, that's at mu 1, and the separation between the two, separation between the two is equal to Q times the applied voltage V. So Q is the charge on an electron, V. So if you take an electron from here down to here, it loses an amount of energy equal to Q times V, because the potential is different by V across the thing. So, right, so when you apply a voltage then, there's two electrochemical potential, and the important concept I tried to get across last day is that current flow really depends on the states that you have within this window. Anything outside does not matter. Right? That's the important concept. Yeah.
Why don't we have bearings? You know, the electrons goes from the source to the channel, and there must be a barrier because there's an interface. And the work function of the source metal is different than the work function of the channel.
Right. So what I'll introduce in a minute is a number that tells you that, supposing I have a level here, let's say, if I put an electron here, how easily will it get out into the contact? Does it get out in a picosecond? Does it get out in a microsecond? Does it get out in a millisecond? What number? And that will include barriers. So if there happens to be a big barrier, it won't get out in a second. If there happens to be a small barrier, it will get out easily. So whatever it is, that's part of that constant. So for this discussion, all I need to know is, if I put an electron here, sooner or later it will go out into the contact. Will it be a picosecond or will it be a millisecond? That's the number I need to know. That's it. That's it. Okay. So so the important thing then is that whatever levels you have in this window is what matters. What's down here does not matter. So for this discussion for the moment, let's just ignore all this, and let's say I've got a level there. So the question is, then, what would the current versus voltage look like? And as I mentioned last day, it would look something like this. That when the voltage is zero, you have a common electrochemical potential like this. When I put a voltage on it, I'm raising this, pulling this down. Current starts flowing when this mu 1 crosses that level, because then we have actually a level within that window. And so you'd expect something like this. We'll step up. So once you have put enough voltage that this level is within this window, you'll get a current through it. Now, what's the magnitude of this current? Well, that's where this question that came up, that it will, how much current you get will depend on how easily electrons can get in and out. Because as I explained last day, current flows because this contact keeps wanting to fill it up, and this contact keeps wanting to take it out. And so electrons keep coming in and going out. Right? So the time it takes to come in or go out, right? So let's say, as I said, if it takes a picosecond to come in and a picosecond to get out, then it would be like an electron would take 2 picoseconds to get all the way. Right? So the current here then, so what I'll introduce is a constant. Let's call this, say, gamma over h bar. I'll call this. Now, the quantity I've written here, it has the dimensions of per second. And there's no good reason to introduce a h bar. I could have just given this a name, something with the dimensions of per second. Now, why I bring in the h bar, I think will be clear a little later. Let's say in about 10 minutes. So we'll get to that. But this has the dimensions of per second. And it just tells you how easily electrons come in and get out. Now, if this is per second, can you tell me what's the units of gamma? Joules, energy. It's like energy, right? Because energy is h nu. Right? And this itself has the units of like frequency per second. Okay, so let's say then electrons go out at the rate of, say, 10 to the 12th per second, which means one every picosecond. Okay, so that's gamma over h bar. And for the moment, let's assume both are equal, though they don't need to be. These are two different contacts. One could be much better than the other. So I could have a gamma 1 and a gamma 2, but we'll bring that in a little later. So if it's the same one, then what I'd argue is that the current you'd get through that level will be Q gamma over 2H bar. Why is that? Well, the way you can think about it is, let's say this is 10 to the 12th per second. So that means an electron comes in every picosecond and then takes another picosecond to get out. So one electron goes from left to right in 2 picoseconds. See? So one electron goes from left to right in this 2 picoseconds, which means the current will be Q divided by 2 picoseconds, because Q is the charge on an electron. So that's basically what you have done here, you see? Q, the 2 here is because if this is 1 picosecond and that's 1 picosecond, overall it's 2 picoseconds. That's why the 2. And so it's Q times the rate at which they come in. And because there's 2 of them, there's 2 there. That's about it. Okay? So that is the current you'd get through a level. That's it. Okay. Now, the question you could ask next is that what about the conductance? This, like, what people call DIDV. That's the slope of this curve. And if you look at this, when I take the slope of this, you'd see it's 0 here, 0 there, and in between, that's where it's non-zero. Okay, so you might think it should look something like this. So what about the max? What about this value of the conductance in here? Well, if you wanted to get a rough estimate, you'd say, well, what we should do is, we should take this current, that's we should take this, and divide it by the voltage range that it takes to make it change from one to the other. So you could say that this maximum conductance would be something like Q gamma over 2H bar, that's the current, divided by whatever voltage range it takes. And we have to figure out this. Now, question is then, how much of a voltage do you really need to go from zero current to full current? Okay. Now, if you look at that picture, what you might say is, well, this should be instantaneous, essentially, because when I'm putting a voltage, as soon as I cross this, it should start conducting. Now, in the real world, of course, one thing that spreads it out, the reason it's not instantaneous is temperature. Why is that? Well, it goes something like this. See, I said that the electrochemical potential separates the filled states from the empty ones. I mean, the implication was everything below mu is filled, everything above it is empty. Now, that's true only at zero temperature. As you raise the temperature, what happens is there's a kind of gray region, you know, where states are kind of half-filled. So usually people define something called the Fermi function. And the way it goes is, let me try to draw this function here. So this axis is energy. And what I'm drawing here is what's called the Fermi function. And at zero temperature, the Fermi function would look like this. Where below the chemical potential, it's equal to 1. And above the chemical potential, it is equal to 0. And right at the chemical potential, that's at mu 1, it changes abruptly from 0 to 1. That's what would happen at zero temperature. Now, what does this Fermi function tell you? Well, it tells you whether states at that energy are occupied by electrons or not. So if it is 1, it means that any state down here is sure to be occupied, 100%. 0 means any state up there is not occupied at all. And mu is the line of demarcation where you go from full occupation to no occupation. And at zero temperature, that line is abrupt. It just happens right at particular energy. On the other hand, as you raise the temperature, as I said earlier, there's a gray area. So the actual function, instead of going from 0 to 1 like this, it actually spreads out like so. Okay. Looks something like this. Spreads out. So goes from 1 to 0 over a range of energies that's of the order of kT. T being the temperature. So this is typically a few kT. You know, I'll give you the exact functional form of this. We'll write down the exact function. That's called the Fermi function. But the point is this change takes place over a few kT. And one, again, useful constant to remember is this kT at room temperature, which means when T is 300 Kelvin, is approximately 25 milli-electron volts. So this change then takes place over, say, 100 milli-electron volts going from here to there. Okay? So what that means is, just because of this, of course, this change won't happen abruptly, but it will be kind of dragged out over a few kT. Why? Because, you see, as you start to cross it, it's not like you'll suddenly find this within the window, because the window is not a sharp one anymore. It's kind of spread out a little bit. So when you try to do this, you'll find the current rises slowly and over a range of, say, a few kT. You know, we could argue 3 kT, 4 kT, something on that order. And once you have the expressions, you could use a computer, plot it out, see exactly what it looks like. But let's say roughly 4 kT. Actually, kT has the dimensions of energy. So if you want dimensions of volts, you should divide by Q. So, because this is energy. Want it in volts, so it's this. So that's one thing you could put in here. So you could say the conductance is inversely proportional to the temperature. So from this point of view, you'd expect that as you lower the temperature, that peak here will keep going up because this thing will happen a whole lot faster. And that's actually something people have experimentally seen with small conductors. You know, as they make it lower, as they take the temperature down lower, it does go up. But this expression actually misses something, and that goes like this. That when you go to very low temperature, as you gradually lower the temperature, this would tell you that the conductance should just keep increasing without limit. Because this is going to zero, essentially. And the point is that with small devices, there is an upper limit to the conductance that people measure. What people have seen is that the maximum you get in a small device, you know, with just one level in the range of interest, is actually Q squared over H, which is a fundamental constant. If you put in those numbers, actually Q squared over H, let me write that here, it comes to approximately 1 divided by 25 kilo ohms. You know, this is conductance. It's like the inverse of resistance. And if you put in those numbers, it'll come to about 1 over 25 kilo ohms. And for a very small device with good contacts, what people find is, experimental fact is, the maximum conductance you get is this inverse of about 25 kilo-ohms. Actually, I should correct myself. What they find is it's really more like 12.5 kilo-ohms, half of this. Why is that? Well, that's because of this thing that I mentioned last day, that all these levels always come in pairs. There's always an upspin and a downspin. So in this discussion, of course, I'm not worrying about that. I said, let's say we have got one level. If you really had one level, then its maximum conductance would be Q square over H. But real devices, ordinarily, even when you make them really small, you'd still have at least two levels there. There would be an upspin and a downspin. And when you have two levels, you can think of it as like two devices in parallel. And of course, when you have two things in parallel, you have twice as much current, twice as much conductance, half as much resistance. Same thing. So what people actually measure is, for small things, is not 25 kilo-ohms, but more like 12.5 kilo-ohms. That's it. Okay. So question is, why is that? What are we missing here? And that has to do with this very important fact, and that is that, you see, I drew this level here in a sharp level, that you have a energy level that's in a sharp, has a very well-defined energy. Now, what quantum mechanics says, and this is what comes out when you treat an electron as a wave using the Schrodinger equation. You know, something will be, this particular thing that I'll be stating now, is something we'll be doing, say, a couple of months from now. Like early in November, we'll try to get it, show you how this comes out of Schrodinger equation. That we'll do later. But the basic point is, what Schrodinger equation says is, when you treat this electron as a wave, yeah, it is a sharp level as long as you don't mess with it, as long as the electron is sitting there by itself, no interactions. But if you are going to pull electrons in and out, then the level will broaden. And it will broaden by an amount equal to gamma. So you've got this one contact pulling stuff in and out at this rate, another one pulling it out at that rate, and so it will broaden out by about 2 gamma. You know, 1 gamma due to this one, 1 gamma due to that one. So the fact that you are kind of not leaving the electron alone, but, you know, putting in and taking it out, that process itself will broaden it out. And that's the form of this, what's called this uncertainty principle, that since the electron stays there only a short length of time, like a picosecond, its energy is spread out by h bar over a picosecond. And roughly speaking, h bar divided by a picosecond comes to about a millivolt or so. So if you're taking electrons in and out by every picosecond, you spread out the level by about a millivolt. You can put in those numbers, you know, just h bar divided by a picosecond is about a millivolt. Okay. So, what happens is, that's what causes this to broaden out fundamentally. And so in addition to this 4kT that I had, there's also a 2 gamma. And of course, I guess now you see why I had defined this as gamma over h bar. You know, as I said, here I was just trying to write the rate. There was no good reason to bring in an h bar. I could have just called this nu, rate at which electrons go in and out. No need to bring in an h bar. But then, of course, this broadening would have been h bar nu. That's all. So instead, I was kind of anticipating that and defined this as gamma over h bar. That's all. So the gamma is really the broadening associated with, you know, electrons going back and forth from that level. Okay. So the point is then, in addition to this 4kT, there's this 2 gamma. And when you go to low enough temperatures, you can drop that. So you have this. And now you see the conductance in this limit of things becomes independent of the gamma. That just cancels out. See? And what you're kind of left with is Q squared over 4h bar. And this is just a rough estimate. I mean, the correct answer is Q squared over h, which is 2 pi h bar. So this, of course, I'm not being very careful about the exact numerical factors. I just say, well, it's broadened by roughly 2 gamma. But if you did this right, and this expression that we'll be deriving in a few minutes, that will get you the right things. And the thing is, then the maximum conductance that you'd get is this Q squared over 4h bar. Now, often you get less than this because in addition to this fundamental broadening of 2 gamma, there can be all kinds of other things. There can be the KT broadening because of the Fermi function. There could be other sources of broadening because the electron interacts with other things, which I don't contribute. But in the limit where the only broadening is due to going in and out, then those two gammas will cancel and you have this maximum conductance. So this, I'd say, is one of the very important pieces of understanding that has emerged over the last 20 years. And I say 20 years ago, this wasn't clear at all. People argued about what the conductance of something really small would be and so on. And this has now been experimentally established over a wide range of conductors, all kinds of materials people have looked at. And this now looks fairly clear and established. So just to complete this then, let me also write down the Fermi function. You know, the Fermi function so far, I said that it kind of looks like this physically. Now there's an exact functional form of this, which, let me write it down. So where should I do this? Take this off. So the Fermi function, F of E, and what I'm writing is basically this function. Now, one thing that might cause a little bit of confusion is, you see, this is a F of E as a function of energy. So E is like your independent variable. F is the function. And normally, of course, you would have drawn it kind of turned around. You know, you usually draw your independent variable this way, and you'd have drawn it like this. Okay. And I've turned it around and drawn it this way so that, you know, this energy kind of corresponds to the levels and you can see the mu's right away. So I've kind of taken that thing and turned it around. Right? So, I mean, at first it might cause some confusion, but once you look at it right, hopefully that's not a big deal. Okay. Anyway, so this function F of E is given by so that's the Fermi function for a given electrochemical potential. Now, where this comes from, that's something, I guess, later in the course I'll try to explain a little better. At this time, I'm just stating it. And as I said, if you look at the nature of this function, it looks reasonable in the sense that you normally expect electrons to be occupying the lowest energy state. So you expect this thing to be filled up to at some point and then empty based on the exclusion principle and the fact that lowest energy states are occupied, and then when you raise the temperature, it spreads out a little bit. Now, of course, there could be many other ways it could have spread out. It's not obvious why it looks like this. That itself requires a little more discussion, which, again, later in the course, I'll try to explain a little better. Okay? But for the time being, let's accept this. So the point is then that you have got two different Fermi functions in your two contacts. Why? Because the two contacts have two different mu's. So Fermi function in contact 1 will involve a mu 1, and the Fermi function in contact 2 would involve mu 2. And pictorially, of course, if this one looks like so, the other one will look like, if I had to draw the Fermi function here, I'd draw something like this. So call this F2 of E. Call this F1 of E. Let's see. This is mu 1, that's mu 2. Okay. Yes?
In this, we have assumed that we can actually pump in and pump out electron at any infinite rate, right? Where will that detail go when we actually try to apply this in some real device?
I'm not sure about the infinite rate, because I'd say it's this gamma over H bar. That's the rate.
Yeah. No, I mean, if there are certain mechanisms which actually say traps the electron at that level, and those kind of details, where does those details go there?
Part of the gamma. Oh. Right? So if you had a level where once electrons get in, it's very hard for it to get out. So the gamma over H bar could be 1 R, for example.
Okay, so does the gamma of the source
indirectly depends upon the gamma of the drain?
No, it's two separate things, right? So it's like if I put an electron here and I ask, how easily will it get out there?
I mean to say that until unless electron vacates the level, a new electron cannot go in. So will the source gamma somehow depend upon the
gamma? No, but the gamma is just the parameter that tells you that if an electron is here, how long will it take to get out? It's just the lifetime of that level. Now, if an electron is not there, then of course there's nothing to get out. But gamma is still the same. It just tells you if one is there, how fast it gets out. Okay, so what I'll try to do then is that here we just went through one level. Now, let's say instead of one level like this, you have some density of states. So this is energy, and here you have a plot D of E. So some density of states. And for this discussion, for the moment, let's assume it's almost constant across. So what do I mean by density of states? Well, as I said, when you have a big conductor, usually you have levels that are very close together. And so instead of drawing individual levels, people just say, well, how many states do you have per electron volt? So that's what density of states is. So it may be, say, 100 states per electron volt. So what that means is if I take a range of energies, one electron volt, there'll be about 100 states there. Right? So that's what this density of states is. Just its dimensions is per electron volt. Okay. Now, now what we'd like to do is write down the current for the continuous density of states like this. So you have a channel with some density of states across the whole thing, and we have applied a voltage, so it goes from mu1 to mu2, and for the moment, let's not even worry about temperature issues. Let's think that the Fermi function looks like this. And question is, what would be the current? And the answer, right, is the current, if I had a single level here, then the current through it would have been Q gamma over 2H bar. Right? That we just discussed, that anytime you have one level and you have a voltage and you have a mu1 and mu2 straddling it, the amount of current that can go through one level is Q gamma over 2H bar. Now, in this case then, what I need to do is multiply this by the number of states I have between mu1 and mu2. How many states do I have in this region? So can you help me? How many? Assuming that the density of states in this region is constant. Question is, how many states do I have? Well, it's equal to that constant density of states times the width of that window. And that's, of course, mu1 minus mu2, which is q times v. Because we agree, this is separated by qv. So I can put a QV. So in this case, when the density of states is essentially constant in that window, I could write the current as current per state times how many states do I have. Well, that then gives you the conductance which is actually the same as that. To see that, you have to remember that this h bar is actually h over 2 pi. And so this 2 will cancel, and what you have then is q square over h times pi d gamma. So, I mean, all I did is, so let's look at this. I'm trying to write the current through this conductor, which has a constant density of states in this region. And I'm saying this is the amount of current that goes through one state multiplied by the number of states in that window. And so the conductance is current divided by voltage. This context, I over V, that's this. And H bar is just H over 2 pi. So you get this formula, it stayed before. And this basically then tells you what does conductance depend on? Well, it depends on the density of states around the chemical potential and the gamma, how easily electrons come in and get out. That's about it. And when you, in that special case where you had a very small device with not a continuous density of state but one level, which got broadened out because you coupled to it, in that case, what happens is the density of states is like, I mean, this quantity maximum value is approximately 1. And that is why the conductance came out at Q square over H. Now, why is that? So, by the way, you'll notice that this actually has the dimensions of, it's dimensionless, in the sense D is per electron volt, gamma is electron volt. So D gamma is really dimensionless. Now, what happens in that special case, let me take this off, is something like this. Now, if you had a sharp level at some point, what would the density of states look like? Can you help me? So, instead of this continuous density of states, supposing I had just a sharp level there, and what would you write? How do you write the density of states? It would be like a delta function. That is something that's, you know, very big right there, but then zero everywhere else, because that means you've got a state only at that energy. Okay? Now, of course, the best way to think of delta functions is something that's very thin, that's got a very small width this way in energy, but then is also very tall, so that the area under this is 1. That's a delta function. As you let this thing get skinnier this way, it gets taller this way, and the area remains 1. That's how you think of a delta function. Okay. Now, what we discussed, of course, is that although ideally a level is like a delta function, but as soon as you connect through to it, it spreads out. And roughly speaking, you could say that it spreads out by this 2 gamma, or spreads out by something on the order of gamma. And, of course, the height of this then becomes like 1 over gamma, because the area has to be 1. And so d times gamma kind of becomes like 1. In a small, so when you are talking about a small conductor with one level only, that quantity becomes kind of like 1. And you get a conductance of Q square over H. That's just to see how that works. Whereas, in general with big conductors, what you have is, of course, lots of levels. And the way you think about it is there's some density of states across the whole thing. Some that tells you how many states per electron volt. And then the correct formula would be something like this. Now, this also actually is somewhat approximate. So what I want to do next is write down the actual formula. You see, the actual expression that you can use to calculate the current voltage characteristics of anything. Now, the reason this is a little approximate is the following. I assume that the density of states is constant. You see, so I said, well, how many states do I have here? I said, well, you know, it's a constant, so I take that constant value and multiply it by the window. Now, of course, in general, this may not be constant. It could be varying around here. And this whole density of states around here could be doing, say, something like this. It could be changing across in energy. So in that case, I can't just take one value and multiply it by QV. I have to do it a little more carefully. So that's what I'll be doing here. So what happens is I could write it then something like this. I is equal to Q gamma over 2H bar. That's the current through one level. And then I have to multiply it by the number of levels. And so what I could say is, in this energy range, let us consider a small range dE. So this is our delta E. So some range of energy is dE. And the question is, how many states do I have in that range? Well, it's the density of states times dE. So I could write dE So this is the current per level. This is the number of states that you actually have, number of levels that you have in a given energy range. So this is current per state, number of states. So when you multiply, that's the current then that you will get through a energy range of dE in that range. So Now, there's one more thing that you can add to this, and that is to take the Fermi functions into account. Namely, you see, so far I've been saying that think of the Fermi function as this sharp thing, which is either 1 or 0. And then you say, well, right around here, this is 1 and that's 0, and we wrote down the current. Now, in general, though, it's like the Fermi function doesn't have to be exactly 1 or 0. It could be like 0.8 here. So, for example, at this energy, if I look here, I might say 0.8. And around here, when I look here, I might say 0.2. So what you'd expect then is that the current that would go through this would be weighted by the difference between the two Fermi functions. So here, it would be like whatever I've written down, but times 0.8 minus 0.2. Because it's the difference. If the two were equal, there would be as much current going both ways, you wouldn't get anything. So the thing is that the correct formula then should be this multiplied by Fermi function in contact E, 1, minus Fermi function in contact 2. So that would then be the actual current that you'd get through an energy range dE. And now I just have one more step and we're done. And this is the basic formula that you need, like for your first homework and to calculate currents through small conductors. I mean, you're almost there. There's just one thing I need to add to it. And what's that? Well, this is the current through a small energy range dE. How do I get the total current? Integrate. That's all. So that's it. That's the basic formula I wanted to get to. And everything else that we discussed, like this conductance formula and all, these are special cases of that, that you could kind of get from that by making certain approximations and so on. But this is basically the one that you could trust. I mean, regardless of the temperature, regardless of the voltage, this is where you could go back to. Okay. And one thing you can see from here then is that if you look at F1 minus F2, that really is the driving term. What? This tells you how many states you have. This tells you how easily you can go in and out. But what really drives the current is this F1 minus F2. The fact that you've got two contacts with two different Fermi functions. One wants to fill it up, one wants to empty it. And that's all expressed through this function. You know, on Monday, I tried to explain why states down here don't matter. Because this contact wants to fill it up, that contact wants to fill it up, nothing much happens. Mathematically, of course, that's expressed through this again. Because when you go down somewhere here, F1 is 1, F2 is also 1, so F1 minus F2 is just 0. So what really matters then is this function, F1 minus F2. So if you look at this factor here, the two Fermi function difference, what you have to do is look at the difference between that function and that function, and at zero temperature, it would look like this. It will be 0 above mu. So this is mu 1. This is mu 2. The difference is Q times V. So at 0 temperature, what happens is it's only in this window that the two Fermi functions have different values. Because one is 1 and the other is 0. And so the difference is 1. Whereas if you go above mu 1, both are 0, so difference is 0. If you go below mu 2, both are 1, so the difference is again 0. So, and that is why, of course, the current is determined by how many states you have in this window. Why? Because when I do this integral, this one will be non-zero only in that window. Everywhere else is 0, so it really doesn't matter. Now, the point I wanted to stress, though, is that that statement only holds exactly at zero temperature. When you raise the temperature, each one of these is kind of spread out somewhat. So more accurate statement would be, it's not just the window between mu1 and mu2, but a few kT above it and a few kT below it. Right? But the important thing is, what matters is only states around here. Mu1 to mu2, a few kT above, a few kT below. That would be the more correct form of that statement. Okay? Now, another interesting thing that also follows from this equation, I just want to state that and we can go. And that is that another way to make current flow through something is, instead of having a voltage difference, to have a temperature difference. You see, the way it works is that, supposing we have exactly the same mu both places. So, you know, we have this also looks like this. So this is mu1, this also is mu1. It's exactly the same, there's no voltage applied. And you might say, well, ordinarily there shouldn't be any current, because F1 and F2 are exactly the same. But what if this one is at a different temperature from that one? So let's say this is cold, very cold, so that F1 really looks like this. And this one is somewhat hot, so it actually looks like that. Now you see F1 minus F2 isn't exactly zero. And the interesting thing is that if you now plot F1 minus F2, what you'll find is, right around mu, it actually changes sign. In the sense that above mu, you see, F1 is 0, F2 is greater than 0, let's say 0.2 or so. So F1 minus F2 is actually negative. So it kind of looks like some negative number here on this side. On the other hand, when you go down here, F1 is 1, and F2 is a little less than 1. So F1 minus F2 is again a positive number. So it actually changes sign right here. So what that means is, above mu, electrons will want to go this way. Below mu, electrons will actually want to be going this way. Because again, the driving term is F1 minus F2, and it changes sign right there. So when you have two different temperatures, you'd actually have, you know, electrons trying to go this way above, trying to go this way below. And if the density of states were constant, you wouldn't get any net current, because there would be some going this way and some going that way. And when you do this integral, it would all just cancel out. But if you had a material where there was some asymmetry in the density of states, so let's say the density of states looks like this. So no states below mu, you only got states above mu. You know, that's some semiconductors, it could be like this. Like this may be the conduction band. Valence band is way down somewhere here, doesn't matter. But the point is, you got states above mu. Well, in that case, electrons will be flowing this way. So you'd actually get a current flow, you see. On the other hand, if you had a material whose density of states looks like this, you know, it's all downwards, and it stops there, no states above it. Well, then you'd have a current flowing the other way. Because now it's, now the driving term F1 minus F2 in this energy range is the other way. It won't cancel out. And the fact is that there are, you know, semiconductors, this N-type and P-type semiconductors, where if you put down two probes, one hot and one cold, depending on which one it is, N-type or P-type, the direction of current will reverse. That's a very common experiment, actually, that you use. You know, just by looking at the current, you can say whether it's N-type or P-type. You see? And basically, it's just this. Anyway, so what I'll be doing then is, I guess today we'll be posting this first homework set, which will be like due in a week or so. And what it will involve is basically this formula. So what I'll do is give you a density of states and ask you to find, evaluate this. But it will be a numerical thing, so you'd have to write a MATLAB code for it. And the code, of course, when you do this integral, what you do is you set up an energy grid. I mean, you set up little windows like this. And then you say, well, what's the current through this? What's the current through this? What's the current through this? And add them all up. Right? You know, that's how I derived this formula. We wrote down the current through a particular energy range. And then we said we integrate. Well, when you try to evaluate it numerically, that's how you do the integral, basically. You just set up little windows in energy, little ranges like this. Find the current in this range. Find the current in that range. Current in that range. Add them all up. And what you try, and I guess what you do is, the two examples I'll ask you to work out is one where between 1 and 2 there's a voltage difference, and the other is when between 1 and 2 there's a temperature difference. Okay? And what you'd have to do is do that integral, and it will give you some practice in terms of setting up the MATLAB codes and all that. Okay, so this will have this ready today, posted on that website, so you can get it from there. And we'll send you an email saying when it's posted up. Okay, thank you.